Luck on Sunday, brought to you by Whirlpool. Bet with the world.
Welcome to the Luck on Sunday podcast, a weekly audio digest of all the best bits of Luck on Sunday, free to air every Sunday from 9 o'clock, that brings you the best guests and insight from around the racing world.
I've got a stellar cast on the sofa today. Certain Harry Cobden is with us, Patrick Wedge, and indeed, we've got Lee Mottershead as well. There they are. It is a day for champions and Cobden realising a dream.
It's Blue Kangaroo with the advantage here under Harry Cobden.
And Rubo's going to win this race for Paul Nicholls. A ninth elite hurdle for Paul, a second for Harry Cobden.
This was a cool ride from Harry Cobden. Burdett Road has remained unbeaten, has won very impressively. Stage Star and Harry Cobden in front are going to make all the running to win the Paddy Power Gold Cup.
It's Stay Away Faye to make it two wins from two starts over fences.
Liari and Harry Cobden win. Sonigino out in front, ridden on towards the line by Harry Cobden, but it's carried 12 stone to victory here, Sonigino.
Jenny's Destiny, who's clear inside the final half of furlong and will record a third win over fences. Jenny's Destiny. It's the former national winner out in front, but here comes Paisley Park near to the line. It's Noble Yates just holding him.
It's Calif de Burley, Harry Cobden on the near side of Give Me Five and Paul O'Brien. Calif de Burley just with his nose in front from Give Me Five, and Calif de Burley wins.
Another 100 yards to go. Monmirel beginning to get up on the near side for Harry Cobden, and it is Monmirel who has won the Pit 10.
Ladies and gentlemen, the champion jockey is Harry Cobden.
Proud parents, I think, Sarah and Will. The family there to enjoy it as well. And caption competition. What did AP say to Harry? I'd still beat you in a finish.
he probably would. No, there's no probably about it. He definitely would. And he said, I said, oh, I'll be doing well to do this for the next 20 years, be 20-time champion jockey. He said, you'll only be 45. I thought, there's no chance of that.
Yeah, fantastic. I suppose knowing all that you've put into it this season, it can only embellish your respect for what it is that he did over a couple of decades.
Yeah, and like, I think this year I ended up on 164. I think his best ever year was 289 or something, so... it feels like I've had a busy year, so God knows what it was like when he was riding.
I've actually got the Racing Post the year he rode his the first 200 for the first time when he beat Sir Gordon Richards. Lee Mottershead with us, Patrick Wedge as well. Lee, I actually got that framed and got it signed. It's up in my house, a lovely little memento. That's, seems a long time ago.
That's a nice thing to have done.
Yeah, very much so.
I'm sure Harry will sign something for you as well.
You wouldn't want me in your house.
Well, you and I go back a little bit. I mean, We met, a decade ago when you were sort of 15 or so, just starting out on the pony racing circuit. We released that piece on social media yesterday where we came down and interviewed you, met your mum and dad. That seems a long time ago, doesn't it?
I think it was, yeah, I'd say I was probably 13 at the time. So, yeah, a good 12 years ago. And we've changed a bit since then, haven't we? Well, I certainly have anyway.
That looked a great day of celebration. I love the way that Sandown have really embraced it. The British Racing have really embraced celebrating the champions of our support. Did they make you feel special yesterday?
Yeah, it was a brilliant day. It made everyone, you know, it was even all my family was over, and they made them all feel so comfortable. They had a nice box and a lovely day out with the racing, and it was just a brilliant day, and the run up to it and everything has just been amazing. And yeah, they've done a really good job about making sure, you know, to make it entertaining and keep it all alive, sort of thing. So, no, it was a really good day, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's great, Lee, that, isn't it? Because, you know, it's not that long ago you'd have just been labelled champion jockey. We move on to the next couple of days and the next season's up and running. But they really do embrace and celebrate it, and they deserve it.
Yeah, they do. I think we do it over jumps better than we do on the flat. I think the nature of the jump season, the way the championship is decided, is more satisfying and makes more sense. And yeah, fair credit to Sandown, to the Jockey Club, to Great British Racing, because the whole package around that final day works really well now. The presentation ceremony before racing is a great addition to the card. You've got the Parade of Champions. We had to delay the Trainers' Championship presentation a little bit this year, although we knew which way it was going. And the racing was great as well. And that's one aspect too of that day now. It seems to get stronger from one season to the next. And the parallel show of the Jumps Trainers' Championship impacted on that this year, because we got so many of those stars from Cliff Sutton coming across as well.
And Harry, are you... as a competitor, are you quite happy with the idea that it's winners rather than prize money? Because I think you, in terms of prize money, you know, maybe riding different horses to Sean, I think you had £1 million+ more sort of pounds of prize money than him. But are you still comfortable and happy that it's winners that count?
I think it's probably right, isn't it? I mean, you could have six good horses in this country, six very good horses, Grade One horses, and win the championship if it was done on prize money. And I think champion jockey's the one that sort of goes hard from the start and gets all the winners on the board. And yeah, I think it's definitely probably done right.
There's a look at how the table appeared in terms of prize money on the left. You can see the disparity, Harry, to Sean Bowen, but both with that 22% strike rate. And the winners through the last couple of weeks, for us, it was fantastic. For you to be in the thick of it, you're riding your own stuff. Are you going away then checking the apps and checking the papers? What was that like to be in the thick of it?
Yeah, so sort of 10 days ago, I think I was 10 or 12 days ago, I was 15 in front, and I thought I'd just got to sort of maintain things and not get injured and just, you know, pick and choose what we're going to ride. And all of a sudden, Thursday evening, Sean got me down to five winners before the evening meeting at Taunton. So the pressure was on, and we had to pull a few out of the bag because he obviously had good rides for the rest of the week at Perth.
And Patrick, for you, it was even more competitive because there was like half a dozen jockeys within a certain number of winners. What was that like for you?
Yeah, it was competitive early on. I kind of didn't really focus too much about it until I got to around about Christmas time, when I maybe started to think that we could catch up. But like, Cinda was amazing to me. She supported me throughout the year, and we were quite far behind when we set out into the year. I think it was one point Bradley Harrison 19, and I was on about 9 or something. That's, you know, as it goes for me, that was a lot to catch up, and I just got supported well. And Wilson Rennick's been amazing to me and getting me rides, and yeah, to have it done is amazing. But I suppose it was very competitive midway through the year.
And yet your father, you said sort of Christmas time, you really started to sort of hone in on it. But your dad revealed yesterday that the idea for it was very much in your mind at the start of the season.
Yeah, I suppose we kind of went into the year maybe half thinking about it, but you can never really commit to them sort of things, because if something was to go wrong midway through the year, you'd just be disappointed. So I suppose it wasn't until, as I say, until I really started to think about it, was around about Christmas time.
Which is remarkable, really, when you think where you started as a jockey and where you are now. I mean, I think, you know, first season, no winners. Second season, one winner. I mean, I think you went your first 40 or so rides without a winner. How hard was all of that in the early days?
Yeah, it was really hard. You know, my first winner was, well, you go to Perth on the Friday, just been 2 years ago was when I rode my first winner, and I think I had 63 rides before I rode that, and it was tough. And I suppose it was the people behind me that supported me, that kind of kept me going, whereas I would have probably packed up long ago. But no, it's amazing to be here now, and it's a bit surreal, because if you told me 2 years ago I'd be here now, I'd have probably laughed at you. So
it's a good lesson, that, isn't it? It's yeah. it's a good lesson on so many levels, about having to work hard, never getting too up or down, believing in yourself, trusting the people around you.
Yeah, it's just, I suppose it's all the whole racing game's all just a mindset, isn't it? You just have to, no matter how you're going, whether you're going well or going badly, you just need to keep going to the next day and keep going forward, and yeah, and enjoy the good days and try and push by the bad ones. So yeah, no, it's been a great couple of years, and hopefully I can keep going.
And Lee, for us, both the Trainers' Championship and the Jockeys' title races as well, it's been a kind of added layer to the final weeks of the season. It's been quite, to watch a little removed has been quite good,
yeah,
good fun.
I think it does make a difference to those final few weeks of the season. To have those stories to report on and to broadcast, as written in broadcast media, and for fans to be able to engage with, I think does make a difference. I think the Jockeys' Championship, it's always great when you have two riders really tussling for it from a long way out. I think particularly because with both the titles, it's not really a financial incentive that the protagonists are chasing. It's an honour. It's that chance to have your name in the annals of the sport as a champion. And I think for that reason, it probably means more than something that is just a financial prize at the end of it. I think Harry and Sean both gave of themselves, not just to riding winners, but to actually promoting the championship tussle in itself, which makes a difference. I think, you know, it's helpful clearly when the participants do that. And we saw that as well in that great British Racing video that Alan John starred in. And I think the Trainers' Championship was a superb story, because in some ways it reflected the narrative of this jump season, with the dominance of Willie Mullins, which ultimately took him to the top of two championship tables.
I'll let you mull on this, but I asked the boys about the idea of should winners count, should prize money count. Some have floated the idea that, you know, you compare the number of winners Dan Skelton has to the number of winners that Willie Mullins has. Should it be prize money rather than winners? Anyway, I'll let you just mull on that. And I want to ask Harry, because Patrick's saying he had it kind of in his mind at the start of the season that it might be a possibility. Where were the discussions? Where was the point between you and Sam Strong where you thought, right, this season we're going to go?
I'd say it was first day of the season last year. We sort of set our stall out and put our heads together and said, right, let's have a go. And my target before the 1st of October was 40 winners. And I think I rode 41 winners before the 1st of October. So we were very happy with that. But I think I was something like 49 winners behind Sean on like the 6th of October. So it was looking slightly unrealistic at one stage. But fair play to Sam and the owners. I had lots of support. I think I rode just over 75 outside winners from Paul's Yard. So we had a lot of support, and met some great owners and trainers along the way, and hopefully built some good relationships.
Great for Sam Strong. First year he's actually had to go, not Paul Nicholls. He had to get busy and work. He earned his corn. Well done. Sam, I talked on a decade or so ago, you and I were sort of meeting up down at your parents in Somerset. You had a little pony back then. You were just dreaming about being a jockey, and the Bowen boys were kind of kings of the pony racing circuit back then, weren't they? Megan Nicholls was one of the fast kids back then as well. So you've known each other a long time.
Yeah, we have. And Sean and James, they had very good ponies. And obviously, Peter could train them a lot better than we could. So so they could probably get a hairy Shetland to go faster than my racing pony. But it's been you know, nice having that sort of association with Sean, just because, you know, we'd known each other so long, and I've sat next to him since I started riding, and And we used to share lifts together to the races. And yeah, it's been a real good friendly championship.
Do you know where he is now?
I think he's probably just landed on holiday. I can't remember where he's gone though.
He's gone to Spain. He joins us live on the line right now. He's probably already slightly more tanned than that picture up on your screen. Sean, thanks for taking out time. How are you today?
Yeah, all good, thank you. All good.
So close. Great competitive end to the season for us. It was terrific for us to watch. What was it like to be in the thick of it?
Yeah, look, it was all good fun until the last couple of days when I knew I couldn't sort of peg Harry back. So the last couple of days were horrible, but up until then it was all good fun for a good while. But yeah, not nice to come out on the wrong end of it.
Well, that in a way that's good to hear, because like a boxer being hit with a heavy shot or knocked down, sometimes that's the stimulus to go on to greater things. Is that kind of your mindset? Is that kind of how you're feeling right now?
Yeah, 100%. Obviously, it makes you hungrier, and it probably makes the success sweeter. So, yeah, look, your toxer and Hexham is on the first day of the season next Saturday, and I'll be there trying to find as many rides as I possibly can and get as good a start as I possibly can. Yeah, like I said, yesterday was horrible. Everyone only says it through the kindness of their heart, saying, "Oh, I'm lucky." But yeah, you just—it's not nice. You don't want to hear it, and you just look, we'll kick on next season now.
And how important is this sort of couple of days for you to get away? Is that to give you some distance? Is it about recharging? What's the idea behind that?
Yeah, just a few days away. Away from it all, but I suppose it doesn't really stop. We only get a week off, so I'll have a few days off, and then I'll be back in the gym in a couple of days, getting ready for next Saturday. So it never really stops, and looking forward to the new season.
And injury is part and parcel of your game, as we know. There's no point having regrets. It's just pointless. It's a waste of time. A waste of energy. But I suppose the flip side of that is, had it not been for that time out in January, you'd have gone really close this year. So it gives you the incentive that an injury-free season next could be on your side.
Yeah, look, hopefully I went sort of 6 or 7 weeks not riding, and I think in 2 months I only rode 3 winners. So, it's a long time off, but at the same time, I came back and I was able to challenge Harry, and I didn't get it over the line. So ultimately, it wasn't good enough, and next season hopefully it will be.
Just to reiterate, it's only been less than 24 hours. It's still sinking in. Champion trainer Willie Mullins, we knew it, but it is confirmed, of course. Rubber stamped yesterday at Sandown, and JP McManus with a terrific Cheltenham and Aintree in particular, winning yesterday with John Bourne. Willie Mullins with confirmation that he is top dog both sides of the Irish Sea. We heard from him yesterday.
Thank you. The champion trainer in Britain, the first Irishman to do it in 70 years. Just summarise the feeling right now, Willie.
Well, it's extraordinary. You know, the legend of the game, Vincent O'Brien, did it 70 years ago. No one ever dreamt that anyone would ever do it again. And here we are, you know, so it's just, I don't know how to feel. It's just, we'll enjoy it anyhow. We're going to start celebrating tonight. I don't know when it's going to stop.
Are these chaps coming too?
Well, they're all... It's extraordinary. Yeah, they're all guys from home, so they...
When you came here today, knowing that the chance was extremely strong of winning the title, I know that we spoke to you earlier and you didn't want to confirm it until it was... Did you acknowledge that there was likely to be this huge outpouring of goodwill?
Not the way it is today, but, I mean, every meeting I've come that I've been to in England all season, in the autumn, winter and spring, it's just been goodwill. People welcoming me over, thanking me for bringing such nice horses over. And, you know, I've been bowled over by the amount of goodwill I've had from the racing fraternity in England and the punters in England. And, you know, it's all positive all the way. Yeah? I'm sure there's other guys that say, you know, go home, but probably a few of my colleagues. But, yeah, it's just been tremendous. There's no Irish-English thing. It's just they want to see nice horses racing in good races.
And when you tried it, you tried a few years ago. I know that you would have had that quench, the appetite to come back for this. At what point this season was the turning point where the ball got rolling and you thought this could be achievable?
After Cheltenham, we were within, you know, we were within, what, 750,000? And I'm looking at the Grand National, I'm looking at my team for the Grand National, and I thought, wow, we have a great team for the Grand National. We could have something to win it, and if we won it, we're in a position. And Iron Maximus came up trumps, with, you know, so with Paul on board. And then we went to Ayr, trying to build on that to get in a position maybe to challenge here today. And then in Ayr, Danny produced McDermott to win the Scottish Grand National, which was just extraordinary. And that put us in a real pole position. And Dan has been fighting Dan Skelton and Paul, but Dan is getting nearer all the time. And but when we looked at the figures today, unless we had a complete blowout and Dan won everything, you know, it was... But I hate grabbing the trophy and say we'll win and then get egg in your face. But anyhow, we did it.
And the last thing I want to ask you, I know that there are some very important people, professionally, personally, and everything in between to you here. Among your great achievements, where does this rank?
It has to rank as one of the best of all, you know, because this is the first time in my lifetime an Irish trainer has come and won the British Championship. Vincent O'Brien, the biggest legend in the game. He was the only guy to do it before that. You know, it's hard to better that, isn't it?
And there we can see we're all living in Willie's world, whether you're Irish, British, or European, or whatever. Maybe it's a global story. Front page news on the Racing Post today, Willie's World. And there you can see, courtesy of nearly 100 less winners than Dan Skelton, a slightly better strike rate. He has a recorded 300,000 plus more than Skelton, who in turn was slightly ahead of Paul Nicholls, the record equaling. We'll have to wait for another year. Churlish, surely, to be talking about numbers of winners rather than prize money determining the title?
Yeah, no, I like to see the jockey's title done by number of winners. I think that's right. And I think it's right that the trainer's title is decided by prize money. Because I think that the role of a trainer and the role of a jockey is slightly different, in the sense I think that it is trainer's job to make the horses the best they can possibly be, and the best they can possibly be would mean they will win more prize money. So I think for them it is a slightly different raison d'etre. And therefore, I've got no qualms with the status quo.
Harry, let me ask you this: from a jockey stroke ditch it point of view, when you're looking at Willie Mullins, when you're going into races at Cheltenham, for example, is there an element of awe, respect, trepidation?
I think have to be in awe of what they've achieved and the team of horses they've gotten. It's absolutely incredible what they do, isn't it? They've just basically, I think, obviously Willie's a fantastic trainer, but they've got so many horses, so many good horses, and you know, they have nearly 70 runners or just over 70 runners at Cheltenham this year. They had a phenomenal team at Aintree. And obviously Ayr was great for them as well, and Sandown. So you've got to take your hat off. And the thing I actually like about Willie Mullins is that he's not afraid to roll the dice. He'll have three or four runners in a race, won't he? And I think he's good for the sport. Oh,
just as well he does, because if he didn't in Ireland, there wouldn't be any runners. And I thought Ruby Walsh made a really interesting point yesterday. And I'll come to that with Lee in due course. There's Willie and Jackie. And there's Patrick, another part of the dynasty. Surely that'll roll on in another 20 years when Willie, if Willie decides that enough is enough. Patrick, you look at someone like Paul Townend, you wouldn't mind being in his shoes for a day or two.
No, you wouldn't, I suppose, eat as much as you sit there and go, now I've got what he's got, and the horses he rides and he gets the opportunities on. I can't imagine the amount of pressure and stress he'd be under going out there every day. And you know, you think you ride you go to a big festival and say you had one favourite, he's got three or four, and you can imagine how much, well, you can't imagine how much pressure that must be, but I suppose in them good days, it'd be an amazing position in, but I suppose he has his bad days as well.
Lee, very briefly, this one of the nice and pleasant surprises, and we shouldn't be surprised because it's horse racing and there are open-minded fans who are in the sport and there are good people who follow the sport as well. But in football, for example, people pretty quickly learned to dislike Manchester United. Then it was Chelsea and now it's Manchester City. Success can breed a form of contempt and envy that suffuse into dislike. But actually this felt on this side of the Irish Sea a general feeling of goodwill towards the Mullins clan.
Absolutely. Willie was saying at Aintree that he was getting the sense that people weren't just wishing him good luck, but saying, we hope you win it, even over here. And yesterday at Sandown, although we've had this ongoing discussion through the season of whether British jump racing, you know, how are we doing relative to Ireland, why is Ireland so dominant relative to Britain? Yesterday's mood wasn't one of soul-searching or introspection. It was absolute celebration. It was applauding someone's really historic achievement. The first since Vincent O'Brien in 70 years to win the British title from Ireland. It was a momentous thing for him to achieve. J.P. McManus, I think, summed it up when he said he only won it because he deserved it, and he did. And I think the warmth was evident in even Harry Skelton. I spoke to him by the weighing room. Bridget gave birth at 5 a.m. yesterday. Son, as yet unnamed, Harry said, we might call him Willie.
Wow. The biggest rival, biggest competitor this season.
I think it was tongue-in-cheek, to be fair.
Yeah, fantastic. Congratulations indeed to them as well. John Bond was one of the stories of the day yesterday. John Bond sticks claim as best two-miler in dominant display. Let me ask Harry, what did this boil down to? Was this just about pure ability? Did tactics and position with him in particular play a part?
I thought Nico gave him a great ride. He was very, very positive. I think John Bond jumped well. When Nico sort of threw him down at a few down the back and the second last, he jumped fantastically well and he was very strong in the finish.
I've always thought, Patrick, particularly early on in his career, his jumping was better when he was positively ridden. It may be coincidence, and obviously he got into a lovely rhythm at Aintree when he was over 2.5. What have you made of his career?
He's had obviously a horse has an amazing career and he's you know done a lot. You know, you buy a horse and you'd be delighted if you could do half of what he's done. I think yesterday was amazing. As Harry said, Nico went out and he made his stake his claims, went out in front and he was really positive on him. And looking back, it seems the best way to ride him. When you get out there in front, and you get him jumping, you get his rhythm. You're on any horse, no matter you're in a grade one or not, if you can get on front and get a rhythm, get jumping, you're hard to beat. So to do that on a horse with so much ability seems the right way to go.
Leaves us with the conundrum, I suppose, is where's he best for next season? And as ever, you're already looking ahead to next season and thinking about the big races ahead. And Nicky Henderson's probably feeling, can we just carry on and have a bit more of this season, belatedly really striking aboard Aintree and indeed yesterday at Sandown as well. But Willie Mullins rubber stamping his supremacy on this side of the Irish Sea with Kakuna wrapping up the final major prize of the season for his team. And I suppose it's a performance, Lee, that he's been threatening to do. And that Irish national has been a precursor, even indeed for Aintree down the years, hasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's been a springboard for so much success. Obviously, this year's Grand National winner came from the Irish Grand National last season. He'd run a big race to finish third at Fairy House. I think the better conditions here helped him. And he's a progressive horse who was a young staying hurdler, had promised to reach grade one potential. Hasn't quite done that, but that was a big win yesterday. Big win for Danny Mullins, great day for Willie Mullins, great day for Nicky Henderson. We should definitely say, ups and downs. The Tizard team lost Alexia Donuts
in the celebration chase, and for them that would have been a devastating day because he was such a stable steed.
Yeah, good point, good point. And we could just see Harry in the maroon and blue there approaching the final fence. What was the story of your race?
He ran a nice race, he just had 12 stone, and that's probably what got the better of him really, but he's a great horse. He had his day at Ascot when he won the 100 grand handicap there, but that was a little bit tough for him there yesterday with all that weight.
And, you know, Patrick was talking about it's great that Willie Mullins runs all these horses in the races. What it does mean, if you're Danny Mullins, I mean, we saw it at the Dublin Racing Festival, didn't we? I mean, you are picking up some phenomenal second or third string rides.
Yeah, I suppose the calibre of horses, even when he was coming over, when he was bringing horses over to Ayr, we were looking at them and getting scared of them, thinking like that's. Like he has them all the way through his yard. So if you could be, if you're second to Townend, you're as you say, you're picking up some serious horses. And whether or not you know Townend's picked the favourite and you're on the 6-1 or 7-1 shot, you've still every chance of beating him, unless it's maybe 1-11 on or something like that. But it must be an amazing place to be in. But I tell you, I sat beside Patrick at Perth. And he's one of the nicest lads in that way. I never really spoke to him, and he was really nice. And yeah, they're just a nice bunch of people that come over.
He had a phenomenal week, Lee, didn't he?
Yeah.
He was, like I said, it was like a Craig David song earlier in the week. And race, you went to Fos Lass on Monday, went to Ludlow on Tuesday, back to Ireland, had a winner at Tipperary on Thursday, and then and so on and so forth.
Yeah. All good ingredients for a nice Racing Post feature, I reckon, because he can write. My God, he can write.
I love the style of his short sentences.
Yeah,
he can
very
write.
Good.
Bit annoying, isn't it?
Talented people.
And you imagine the way he talks, the way he thinks, and Willie will probably never retire, but the conveyor belt is there, the pathway is there, Lee, I suppose, for the next generation.
Well, I said they've got such an incredible team there, haven't they? You know, when you've got people... not in the background, but key squad members like David Casey and Ruby Walsh offering their input, offering their guidance, offering their thoughts. They really have got an incredibly strong squad of people as well as horses. And that must make such a difference too, because you look at the way they operate and they are clearly not just, they're a magnet for the best horses, but that's because they're a magnet for the best owners as well. You know, and that's the key issue. If we're talking about British racing v Irish racing at the minute, or British racing v Willie Mullins, it is built around the fact that Willie Mullins does attract all the top owners. You had an example like yesterday with Simon Meunier and Isaac Swade. El Fabiola didn't win, Ampere Pass did, but they had one, I think, British trained runner yesterday, called me Lord in the select hurdle. Now, once upon a time, all their best horses, their best young horses, were primarily trained in Britain, and that isn't the case anymore. What they have done reflects a move that others have made, and unless that is corrected at some point, it will be hard for British stables to compete, because that movement of British owners to Ireland isn't just a symptom of Ireland's dominance, it's a cause of Ireland's dominance as well.
He's a classic winner, he's a multiple Group 1 winner, but he has traded a very successful career in the UK for riding here in Hong Kong, and joins me now on Luck on Sunday in what I can only describe as the pouring rain at Sha Tin. Andrea Atzeni, thank you for your patience today. Hopefully we're not going to get completely drenched sitting here, but you won't mind, because this has been a very fruitful mission so far, hasn't it?
Yeah, no, thanks for having me, Nick. And yeah, he has. You know, it's been something different for me. Obviously, I've been here now in Hong Kong for, I think it's about 8 months. And it feels like I arrived yesterday. Time has gone very quick, which is obviously a good thing. When time goes fast, you're obviously having a good time. And things have gone pretty well so far. I started off pretty good, you know, riding my first winner at a second meeting in Hong Kong, and he just all picked up from there. I've got a lot of support from most of the trainers and a lot of different owners, and I must say, it's probably gone a little bit better than I expected, but I'm that stage now where, you know, you just want more and more, and I had a target to achieve, which I have already, and now I'm hoping to achieve a different target, in a sense of numbers of winners, and at the moment it's looking quite positive.
So what was your target when you arrived?
I must say I was hoping to ride 30 winners for this
which
season.
Is a lot in Hong Kong.
It is. Like, that doesn't sound a lot, but 30 winners in your first season in Hong Kong, it's... I think it's pretty good. And so far I've ridden 36, which is... It's a good number. At the moment I'm fifth on the jockey's table. I've had a couple of setbacks, a couple of suspensions, which sort of put me on the back foot for a little bit. I missed a couple of winners. But now we're up and running again and looking forward to the sort of back end of the season.
So take me back to when you left the UK and what triggered the decision to come? Because it's not as though your career was on the skids or you'd been forgotten about. It was still going okay.
Of course, yeah. I was definitely going, doing well enough to stay in England, and I wasn't planning to come to Hong Kong at all. I was actually looking forward to be a freelance jockey for the first time in 10 years. You know, being a retained rider for so many years, it's my first time since, I don't know, 2014 or something.
So you'd been Sheikh Mohammed Abaid's jockey for 9 seasons?
Correct, and I did 1 season with Qatar Racing.
Yeah.
So that's 10 years as a retained rider. So that was my first season, full season, being a freelance jockey. And I was actually really looking forward to it because it was a different challenge. I was ready for it. And but yeah, and then all of a sudden, I got a phone call from a member of the Hong Kong Jockey Club.
Out of the blue?
Out of the blue, yeah. I was
didn't see it coming, you weren't courting it, you weren't flirting with them, nothing?
Not at all, no, I didn't. It was on the back of my mind one day I would eventually apply to come to Hong Kong again, because I came here in 2014 for a very, very short period of time. And I knew one day I was going to come back to Hong Kong, not so much as a full-time jockey, maybe just to spend the winter in Hong Kong. But at this stage of my career, it was in the back of my mind.
Fine.
And all of a sudden, this Hong Kong number rang up, and it was a member of the Hong Kong Jockey Club, and he asked me if I would come to Hong Kong as a full-time jockey. And it caught me by surprise, but I left my doors open. I didn't obviously give him a straight answer. Obviously, I put a lot of thought into it, and I spoke to different people that I knew that could, you know, help me with my decision. It's like anything in life, you can speak to as many people as you can, but the end is all down to you. It was down to me whether I was ready or if I wanted to come or not. And
So what was the driving force behind taking the plunge?
I'm not quite sure. It was one of those things. Is I'm at that stage of my career where I'm lucky enough that I've done well enough in Europe to say that. You know, prestige is great, which, you know, that's what you get in UK and in Europe, you know, winning big races, winning all those group ones. But at the end of the day, I'm at that stage of my career where prestige can only take you so far. And it comes down to a little bit to the financial side of it. At the end of the day, I'm not going to be a jockey forever. Mm-hmm. I'm 32. And so I sat down and I thought, well, the only way I can retire in 10 years' time and be financially secure is to come to Hong Kong. And also, I think I just needed a new challenge. I just needed something different. Losing the job with Sheikh Mohammed Abaid, it's like anything. When you lose a big job, it's a little bit upsetting. But it's like anything in life. Nothing lasted forever. I knew that was going to come eventually, and I was prepared for it. And I think I just needed something new, something refreshing, which coming to Hong Kong, it really done me well.
Why did you lose your job?
I'm actually not quite sure. It came to... obviously, I worked for Sheikh Mohammed Abaid for 9 years, and I I became very, very close to Sheikh Mohammed Obaid. I'm actually probably a lot more closer now than I was when I was riding for him.
So and you're still in quite regular contact?
Yeah, very much so, very much so. I keep in touch with him. You know, we speak every other week. He rings me when I'm in Hong Kong. He actually follows Hong Kong racing too while I've been out here. The reason why I lost it, I'm not quite sure. I think he just came to a conclusion that Sheikh Mohammed Obaid decided to expand his horses with different trainers. Mm. And I must say, all the trainers, they decided to send horses. They all obviously had good jockeys in their own stables. So I think he came to a conclusion where he thought, I think he'd rather let the trainers use their own jockeys.
Yeah.
And then it became to a conclusion that, you know, it was a good time for me to him and to part ways. And he's done very well.
But as you say, that takes away that security that you did have.
Mm.
And not many jockeys do have. So when you lose that security, you seek it somewhere else. And now you're seeking it here in Hong Kong. When you first arrived here, after a week, what were you thinking?
To be honest with you, there hasn't been a minute since I've been in Hong Kong that I've regretted my decision. When I've arrived, I've been into Hong Kong before, but I knew this could be, like, I was planning to stay here for a little while. And so I was mentally, my mind was already pretty much here. My mind was in Hong Kong before I even arrived in Hong Kong. So mentally was pretty much prepared to my new challenge. When I arrived, it was just different. The only thing I was worried about, Nick, before I came to Hong Kong, that whether my riding style was going to adapt to Hong Kong racing.
How did you think it needed to adapt?
Because I'm pretty much a jockey that he likes to get a horse into a nice rhythm, let the horse get comfortable, and then, you know, just let the horse sort of develop into the race and, you know, and then have a good go at the end. Whether here it happens, everything ups a lot quicker.
So do you have to make things happen here?
100%. Like, you can't just come out of the gates here and say, well, I'll come out and I'll get in some stage and it'll open up for me. It doesn't work like that. Here in Hong Kong, the gates is very important. Gate speed and position is very important.
So you have to be a bit more urgent.
Yeah, a lot sharper. Make decisions a lot quicker than you would anywhere else in Europe. And the race a lot tighter than they would do in Europe. Like, you know, the race fairly tight. And you're riding with some world-class jockeys too. But I must say, I was actually quite surprised how sort of quickly I adapted to the style of racing. And another thing that worried me, that I've always had an agent. Like, I've been a jockey for 15 years, and I've always somebody looking after me, booking my rides or helping me to book my rides everywhere I've been in the world. But in Hong Kong, it doesn't work like this. In Hong Kong, you've got to look for the rides. You've got to book your own rides. You haven't got an agent. So it's all down to yourself. But it's like anything, it takes time. And I'm trying to get around things, but I'm not there yet. But I've only been here 8 months, so.
Alessio Ponsalab, absolutely fantastic. And the man himself, recently, very, very recently retired, joins us now, Olivier Pellier. Olivier, thanks for joining us on Luck on Sunday. How are you?
Very well.
You said a few days ago that it hadn't quite sunk in, the magnitude of it all. You've had a couple of days. How are you feeling about it all now?
Oh, now it's like more relaxed. It's the first time when I wake up in the morning, I don't check my scale and just make a relax. And it's like a lovely day. It's different. But, you know, it's like same when you win a big race, at that day, you don't know exactly how you win. And it's the day after you imagine, okay, yes, like I win the derby, I win the many races, but like after I'm not tired, and wake up in the morning and just say, okay, now you can see how I feel the rest of my life, like for races.
That's fantastic. And the French are big food lovers. You don't have to think about your weight anymore. Do you love your food? How much are you looking forward to that part of your life?
everybody loves the food or drink or whatever, but you know, it's like when you're on the diet, you need to check everything. So now it's more relaxed, but you know, I just take care because normally after, like you take some pound over. So you know, but I just ride the horse on Tuesday and Wednesday. Ride the horse. I ride the 2 years old and make the French Championship on June. So I need a fit and well, and also you know I love horses. So you know I need a ride in the morning.
Yeah, okay. You're gonna take over. You're gonna keep fit. How was Thursday at La Teste for you emotionally?
Emotionally, when you win the big race, nobody know exactly how you feel, but La Teste is more sad because you think you know competition. You have another competition, but now it's finish. No more competition. Everything is done, and it's you really stop. So then you know you cannot ride the competition. And very sad, and everybody's still there, and have a lot of friends, of course, and everybody, you know, you say, okay, how you win, all the groups, and for the Arabs and Thoroughbred, and the people, you know, you say, you know, you can imagine you're a 502 group around the world, so it's amazing. So then, you know, when you watch, only one guy, you say, Frankie the Tory. Okay, but then the race in France is nobody have the same thing, so it's very sad and I won't cry. But you know, after I said to the journalist, you know, when the thing is coming and your heart is very stressed. I prefer to say stop and change because you know when you have a question, put once and after I prefer to change because if I stay, I'm crying. Of course, the trainer Thomas Fossey is coming next to me, and he's crying. So you know, one is crying, two is crying, and then after is they say, next is my turn.
I don't think any of international racing fans can imagine Olivier Pellet crying. We're so used to seeing you with a big smile on your face. Let me ask you this, Olivier: sports people often have to replace that excitement from. Say from your riding, maybe you have to replace the competition that pushed you throughout your career. Are you that kind of person where you will have to do something else, something different?
It's everybody push for me. It's the first time I ride the horse on the track. Is not favorite because my last ride is canceled. I have a good chance and the horse is canceled. And one jockey have some pens, so I take his ride. And before, you know, I don't know if the owner is saying, you know, maybe he say yes or no, and the trainer. Then they say, okay. And everybody know I have no chance, and everybody bet on the horse just for me. It just helped me, you know. And then after, everybody claps in their hands. And when I come back, everybody claps in their hands, you know. But everybody have a ticket, and they ask to me to sign the tickets because it's my last ride. So it's the first time when you have no chance and you finish nowhere and everybody claps in the hands. This is only for the sports and support me. That one is really very good.
That's a beautiful story. That is a beautiful story. And you've become a favourite all across the world. You've ridden Japan Cups, you've ridden Breeders' Cups. You're very, very fondly remembered and thought of over here in Britain as well. What would you say was maybe the most important horse for your career to take you to the places that you've gone?
The first, I think, Panto Celebre for the Arc. Because I'm very young, it's my first contract. And then after the filly Goldikova, because she won everywhere, England, America, France, of course, but 14 Group 1, the amazing filly, and three-time Breeders' Cup. Three-time Breeders' Cup is not usually to win like that. And of course, in Japan, I have some, in England, but it's for the horse I keep is Panto Celebre and Goldikova.
Oh, Goldikova was She was beautiful to watch, just gliding gracefully through races. That blend of acceleration and class. What was she like to ride?
Honestly, when you ride her in a very steady canter, no action, very stiff, and then after when you just accelerate, is a machine. Whereas like when you push the button, she just keep going like a typical French horse. You follow the pace, and then after the acceleration.
Like a fast car. Was there a favourite day that you had with her? She was good when she beat Paco Boy at Ascot, the Breeders' Cups, of course. Did you have a favourite day with her?
Breeders' Cup is Breeders' Cup somewhere, but, you know, I think his good emotion is the Prix Jacques Le Marois. She's coming, and she wins so very well, you know, because it's first time, because she's very complicated to go to the stall. So then after when she's inside, and I say it's like my win. And then after, everybody from the stable and the farm is coming at the track. And, you know, and she wins so easy. And she's flying the three last furlong. She's just flying. It's like when you feel the power to go. And, you know, like when you accelerate, you say, nobody catch me. And then after the last furlong, she's just flying. That one, yes.
She was beautiful. She was class. She was brilliant. A Frenchman to win the English Derby, that is quite something. You did it on High Rise. Tell us about that experience.
High Rise first, Mr. Comani said, OK, take a good position, take a good feel. But for me, you know, the horse, the race is very fast and I cannot follow the pace. So then after I'm running behind, but... the exception, because it's very hard for like a French rider, but you know, the horse is well, he's in good form. And then after, okay, after you need a change, this is like my job, you need a change, the rule is like, okay, now I cannot take a good place, okay, I change and I ride after for me, because now the trend, everything is gone. And then after when the horse, you know, he just pick it up and just keep going. And after the last furlong, you know, he's coming and he fights well. Very hard, a nice fight, and then when you win just before winning post, after that you say yes, and it's a derby, you know, it's like a pigot, you know, everybody, you know, want to win the derby, but you know, when you like the French rider, I'm very young, and win the derby, like a win one time in the arc is like fantastic, but win the derby is not like more, but you know, it's very hard. And for my memory, yes, my trophy and everything, when I watch, I say, yes, I'm the one.
I did it. Your agent, Chippy Ellis, long-term agent and friend, spoke to Nick Luck earlier on this week. He said Olivier was always a big kisser, always kissing on the cheek, celebrations. He said he had to remind you not to kiss the Queen, did you?
No, because before, you know, when I win the derby, the guy, first time he say, please, Olivier, don't kiss the Queen. He say, oh, really? Why? You know, when you're happy, for us, like for French people, you say hello, this is normal. They say, no, not the Queen. They say, oh, okay, this is the rule. Okay, if it's the rule, no problem. But Chippy, you know, I have so very good memory with him. First is my first agent, but he's the friend after, because, you know, when you work for him until, you know, it's so many times for the first time. And, of course, he's like, he's not the agent, he's like my second dad, because you stay wake up in the morning, watch the horse, speak with the horses and the life and how is your life. He know my life and I know his life. And also when, you know, when... you prepare the horse, and when you go to the training, like work Harbinger, and say, how you think of this horse? And then you say, oh, Harbinger, hey, wow, that one is superstar. And then after when you won like 10 lengths, and it's so exciting, and you can drink after and just enjoy. Yes, this is the life. You need the race in England is like that, you know. You need win the race, just enjoy, take a good thing. This is really good.
We're back here at Sha Tin. I'm joined by the chief executive of the Hong Kong Jockey Club, Winfried Engelbrecht-Breskus. Winfried, thank you for having us again.
Thank you for coming.
I'm sorry you couldn't organize the weather for us. That's one thing you can't do. You can run everything else in global horse racing. You can't fix that.
Not yet, but you know, it was raining heavily before. Now we at least only had a drizzle for the interview.
So how's the season been?
The season from a sporting point of view has been extremely exciting. If you see the highlight of horses, of the races we had, and especially the Longines International, we have a little bit a challenge that the horse population was not optimal. Mm-hmm. Because after COVID, a lot of people could not buy horses, could not go overseas, and then they retired in a way their horses because they felt COVID, I cannot invite friends. So our horse population was not optimal. We have now back to the population we had last year. We have invested heavily even to encourage more people to buy horses. Our PP scheme has worked extremely well. So I looked at the ballot results, which shows that especially the appetite for good horses with a PP is good.
Just explain that for those who aren't aware. Mm.
So you have the proven horses,
the
so-called PP, private purchase, and you have the PPGs or Griffins. And we had a relationship which was not optimal. We had too many unraised horses coming in. So we put an incentive scheme in. If you have a class 3 winner and above, the PP, you get a bonus of 1.5 million Hong Kong dollars. So
that's what, 150
sterling. So that definitely whetted the appetite of our owners to go out for buying good horses. And if you see Massive Sorrow is one of the examples that these horses can come in, settle in and winning in the second start the Derby, which is not normal, but I are really optimistic that we bring new young horses in. And if you look at our four-year-olds, there are some very exciting four-year-olds. So I'm principally optimistic going into the next season. This season was a little bit of changing of the guards. Economically, turnover-wise, one can see definitely that the global pandemic and inflation and as well as the economy had an impact. So our local turnover is down by around 9%. Mm-hmm. But we compensated partially with a significant increase in our commingling, which is up 12%. So in the end, we will be down 6%. But we had a tremendous growth. I'm not too concerned. I think the next 1 year, 2 years with economic changes will be a challenge, but we have confidence that we go back in the growth path in a year or two.
There is an assumption in the rest of the world that everything in Hong Kong's garden is rosy. You paint a much more pragmatic, realistic picture. How do you keep people wanting to own horses in Hong Kong?
If you see, for example, Happy Wednesday, when you see the enthusiasm of
this is a Happy Valley every Wednesday, which is a big entertainment experience.
It's but for owners, it is where they bring their friends. Mm-hmm. The great sport we have on the Sunday and the big meetings, the incentives to have a horse and be on the big stage, being winning the Derby or being in the international stage, shows a significant interest. And we see a great interest coming from mainland China. We have now around 1,500 members in mainland China in Beijing. We will open up a new clubhouse facility in Shenzhen, where you have a lot of young entrepreneurs who are very interested to join the sport of horse racing. So we see, in a way, significant growth potential coming from this part of the country. So I'm optimistic that we will have a much stronger even horse ownership with a younger ownership, because a lot of the young entrepreneurs who have become our members, they're around 35 years old. So therefore that supports in a way our growing of our membership, plus our international owners, where we have now international owners selectively with a mainly beat breeding background coming into the fold.
I'm interested though that you focused on the experience an owner can have at the race course. Something I feel that other countries don't focus on enough, that it's a social experience for them. They can bring their friends, they can have fun, they can spread the message, they can spread the love, and that's how you get more owners in the game.
I think for me, while we probably the most digital platforms globally, we can have 95% of our wagering turnover on digital platform. We have 2.6 million accounts, where every race meeting around 1 million accounts are active. But the real deep love and appreciation of horse racing as a sport and as a social activity is at the track, and if you see how much money we have invested in facilities and how much money we will invest more in facilities to create, in a way, this unique experience when you go to the races. And for different customer segments, we will invest around $350 million in a new venue for Generation Z and Y. So we are very focused on customer centricity, but bringing them to the racetrack, because the real excitement, you don't get, in all respect, on TV. You get, in a way, it here at the track, and that's our focus.
I get it. I mean, I look at this racetrack here, and it was way ahead of its time when it was built. Yeah. But it is in the model of a traditional global big racetrack. What does a Generation Z racetrack look like? What does it look like? How is it different from what we're used to?
First of all, you will not have many classical table sit-down. It's much more community areas, and you have to be able to connect to your friends who may be not there at the track. So it is a real connectivity where you have much more fun, entertainment, and you can do at any time what you want and connect to your friends.
So go on, so give me a tangible example.
So a tangible example, in a way, you can, in a way, first of all, if it comes to wagering, you have a group of friends who exchange their views and they place a bet together. Mm-hmm. It's not the individual ones. They connect even when they're at the races. And I talked to a lot of others who have similar experiences. The attention, you cannot ask them to be 6 hours at the racetrack and look at every half hour there's a race.
Yep.
You have to mix completely different experiences, what you can do, and we will have a lot of virtual reality, augmented reality games in the venue. You can theoretically then ride with your friends who are not in charting. You can ride a race together and you can simulate an upcoming race. So it's a highly digital connectivity. And everything will be, in a way, for that you as a group decide what you want to do, and not we tell you, this is what you do, this is where you have to sit, this is what you want to do at this moment. So it will be much more agile and geared for the customer and not a classical race-going experience. Mm-hmm.
And one thing I did notice at Happy Valley, and we've talked about this before, is that when you have entertainment at the races, so you have music or whatever you've got, it is within the race meeting. It's not something separate or over there or afterwards. It is part of the whole experience.
Exactly. And we are in the entertainment business. And racing is part of the entertainment. And music is part of the entertainment. So what we have designed, you have these windows of 7 minutes where you have then the entertainment. And the interesting part is when the race comes, people really go to the rail. If you look at TikTok, Instagram, other social media, they connect instantly and their friends getting involved in the race meeting. We will, in a way, have next season we plan, we have this two-screen approach. We have a classical screen for our hardcore customers. We will have a completely even different showing of the races, different graphics which show very data-driven. Similar what you see in Formula One, you will see completely different form and how you process and present information for a different generation who is much more graphical orientated than looking at our classical Otterbord.
It's the beginning of the Whirlpool season as well, globally. We know full well from all the executives in the UK how important it is to them. How important is it to Hong Kong's business model? Mm-hmm.
For me, in a way, if I look at racing as a global sport, and you cannot, from my point of view, looking only now at one jurisdiction. If you want to lift the sport and create a global audience, we have to lift our whole game to a global business. We have invested now even more in creating a new technology platform, which will enable us even to create more interesting bet types. But on this platform, you could theoretically even have fractionalized ownership, tokenization. You could even trade. So the commingling, the wagering, coming back to this part, for us, I think commingling, and this we started really commingling 15, 16 in a bigger way, If you see now, Promigny turnover this year will be reach 29 billion, including race, including world pools. So it is an income which is significant for the club. And the more we globalize our product, and you know, our customers know all the big races around the world, and when the horses come here, it grows the business. I personally think there are, if you look at players now, we have expanded the number of commingling partners to 70. We have now 26 countries where racing, our racing is transmitted. I would like to see all the best races in the world on World Pool platforms so that we create a global customer base, which should help the sport and should help us from the revenue side to grow our business.
Winfried, thanks for talking to me. All the very best for a very successful race day.
Pleasure, and see you hopefully tonight at the FWD party. It's the eighth floor, which you should, in a way, put on your social media and shows it's a unique place.
If I'm not there, I don't think I'll be coming back. Winfried Engelberg-Breska, CEO of the Hong Kong Jockey Club.
Luck on Sunday, brought to you by Whirlpool. Bet with the world.